Good evening, everybody, and welcome to the Gloucester Writers' Center. Tonight, it is a pleasure to present Jay Featherstone, who will read from Glass, his new book of poems. I am before you to give an introduction to this stunning collection. While reading these poems, I began to think of the poet James Laugenbach, who wrote in his book, The Resistance to Poetry, quote, "The wonder of language depends less on meaning than on the ways in which it means." I remember the first time I read Laugenbach's poems in his book, Fleet River, how the poems began to take my breath away, and I needed to put the book down for a while. This was happening as I was reading Jay Featherstone's poems in his book, Glass. Was I reading differently, in such a way that I held my breath, as I am now? Nothing is wasted on these pages. On the contrary, there are the armatures of other books here, the hearts of lived experiences that are still beating, and songs waiting to be played and sung. Readers will begin to notice that traditional hierarchies are disturbed. The poem Good Harbor is an example of the kind of moves Jay Featherstone makes to take us numerous times to places other than those we anticipated. We hardly ever see one thing at a time, even at the beach, if that is where we are, and all at onceness is present. So much resounds here. The poem on one page mentions two fathers, one mother, one wife, Marx, Shelley, Rosa Parks, Buddha, the Shakers, and the Poplars of France, to name a few. This poet recalls also a friend from Japan who compares lives to a row of mirrors. Quote, "One person gives, another takes. Infinite obligation." The image of mirrors reminded me of the great French filmmaker Agnès Varda in her amazing late documentary film, The Beaches of Agnes. Let's see. There is a scene where she and her friends and family are carting mirrors to the beach and lining them up. Everything is mirrored ad infinitum. We stand on the shoulders of others and set out. And this is a rebellious book. The first person, the beloved lyric I, plays second fiddle to others and to the natural world. In many places, so much is seen and with such adoration that the viewer is less important than the marvelous birds the earth offers with such promise. Nature and the surroundings of humans are front and center in many poems, coexisting ecologically. Take a look at these other titles: Seneca Falls, Yokohama, Kinglets, Moss, Grand River, Silverweed, Glass, Swallows, Softer Metal. In these titles, and in the many first lines, the lyric I is subordinated, but not disconnected from human lives and memories. This is part of the process in which meaning is sought after, a true meaning. Poems need not satisfy nor enable complacency. Life can be overwhelming and maddening. Despite Shakespeare's sonnets, there is hardly resolution at the end of some of these poems, often a small shock. Jay, as an educator, a great teacher, has always worked with others, poets, and other teachers, and valued that process. In this book, he is passing on reflections and recognitions of an awakened life, one that has been enriched as much by teaching as writing in both prose and poetry. Although the first person is not always prominent in these poems, the tenderness, compassion and music is present everywhere. The precise and original choices in diction, various rhymes, echoing vowel tones, and similar consonant sounds resonate, an ingenuity that works the mind and the heart. I took my time with this book, which offers and asks for so much. Something sacred is going on here. When I came to the last poem, it occurred to me, with the epigraph from Nietzsche, that the poet could be a goldsmith, practicing lento, going slow. He thinks, quote, he might acquire a pair of scales to weigh what the day brings, unquote. Like the first silvery mosquito, unquote. This is how the collection winds up, with a mosquito. This is how we can stop time, by ending the, quote, mad dance, unquote, and taking note, as Jay writes, of the circle of children who drop hands.
It's always such a great pleasure to read in this room, because the scale is so different from the scale of most places. I mean, it really is chamber music, right? And here we are in the chamber. The Gloucester Writers' Center, I just have a constant debt of gratitude to this place and to Anne and Henry, and also to Dorothy Nelson, whose work here I really admire. Dorothy has done, for many years, the workshop for veterans writing about their war experiences, and that has produced some very moving and powerful work, as well as some real healing among some of the people doing it. There are millions of people to thank, but I'd like to get on with the poems, and I will. I'm reading poems mostly tonight from Glass, which is this work that's just come out, but I also wanted to read some poems, a scattering of poems from my first poetry book, Braces Cove, partly because actually in the readings I've done locally around Cape Ann and in Boston in recent years, I've actually read more things from what became Glass than I have from Braces Cove, and so tonight I'd like to remind folks that Braces Cove is not only still a book I stand by, but also it's of course named for a Gloucester geographical site, the little cove that's just south of the Back Shore and north of Eastern Point, which I think is one of the most beautiful places in this whole part of the world. And as I'll explain, has a special status for me. So I'm going to start. I'd first want to start with a song, because that seems like a very good way to begin a poetry reading. This is called Remembering a Japanese Song on Eastern Point on a July Evening. At dinner, steam, bluefish, the old big life, my small existence now. My grown daughters love Brooklyn, two bites in the apple. I scrub skin and scales off family plates, take the trash out, smelling privet and no raccoon. I step into new night, Cygnus low in the ash tree, the Milky Way pouring down. From the lake of darkness below my feet, fireflies rise toward Venus. What is that old song? Water lilies, filling with rain, tipping, filling again. And then the first poem in Glass is actually a kind of manifesto disguised as a joke. I grew up in an Irish Catholic family, very devout. I was an altar boy, and believed fervently, except when people told me about limbo, the place where unbaptized children have to go. And I thought, what's that? That's crazy. And it was the beginning, I think, of a long unraveling for me, although I still bear the imprint of a Catholic education in good ways as well as bad. So the headline caught my attention. Catholic Church rejects limbo. Reuters. We follow a loose thread from the hem of a cotton dress to a border, the vast rim of vanished children in the arms of unknown nurses, their cries rising unanswered, zone of slippage between life and life, repository and keep and dump of treasured and wasted things, unfulfilled vows, the cat gone missing, and all those on this earth baptized only by the waters of kindness. O Reiko, tell me the story again. Your grandfather, home on his last furlough from the Pacific War, the black lacquer chopsticks flashing as he taught his small daughter how to hold one grain of rice. Then this one is kind of a good introduction to a lot of things. It's called Coastal Work, and it's a lot of things, as you'll see. But it takes off from the fact that the Rosa rugosa on our beaches and around all over Cape Ann, the common beach roses found along all three coasts, the Atlantic coast, the Pacific coast, and what we who have lived in Michigan call the third coast, the Michigan waters. They're originally immigrants from China. They came probably in the ships. At the market, the Chinese cook courts Yankee scorn by buying chicken feet for soup stock. Such delicate flavor, blossoms opening in an old Chinese print. Granite bosses gave the newcomers jobs, laundering New England's air. The migrants offered their home silks to the terns, holding the wounded coast together, hanging tough when nativist northeasters went berserk. We Irish rolled in on the same fogs. One slim girl stole the money for passage. My grandmother shamed my father's American boyhood by snatching horse manure off the streets. She used it to bank flowers as fine as a child's cheekbone. My mother was another of the fog people, a named Irish rose, born and buried inland, though she loved sea crossings. She always scrubbed the counters for a fiesta, and she would clap today to see fellow immigrants gathering at Brace's Cove. I see her partying with Chinese philosophers at the blue top of the vernacular beach, offering thanks for ruby hips, shaking her head with the old timers over the new coins for happiness. I see her joining other exiles in praise of the three lasting things, growing rice, poetry, and children. I see her doing essential coastal work, translating it fresh on threatened beaches, a formal ancient beauty, turning the immigrant's old prophet on bird feet. This is for me, right?
It is.
Thank you so much. This next poem is from the new book. It's called Bodhisattva, and you know Bodhisattva is a figure in Buddhist tradition who achieves enlightenment and sometimes resolves, instead of disappearing into enlightenment, to stay in this fallen world and help people out. The Bodhisattva who's revered in Japan, where I grew up after World War II, the Bodhisattva who's especially revered is called Kanon. And this poem starts from two American boys, my brother and I, visiting the shrine in Kamakura near where we live, of Kanon, the temple of Kanon. And then it goes, winds around, several other things. My brother is already, at the beginning of the poem, Alzheimer-ish. There's a surprise in the poem, which I should alert you to, which is that my brother and I disagreed, not violently, but disagreed very much, very strongly, about my father, who I was always an opponent of, and my brother always revered. And when my brother got Alzheimer's, he started to remember that he too had been beaten up all the time by my father. Mm-hmm. And so, strangely, we were allies, but rather late in the game. So, and this is about how to live life under such circumstances. Bodhisattva. My brother Edward emerges from the mist of his second shower in 5 minutes. I propose clothes. He looks at me, Alzheimer-ish, fingering a rib. In 1948, two boys stand in the dim temple in Kamakura, trying to read compassion's gold impassive mask. Kanon, believe in our inventions. We will practice your virtues. Off Hayama, the great wave falling toward us, Arctic cold, jade green, Edward shows me how to cup hands for the fast swimming stroke that saves us. Our father hovers, uninvited, on the unlit porch of my brother's dementia. Edward has always revered him. Now the mind's wreck liberates memories of the old man's raised fist, the blue eyes pale with drink. Edward hates his father now. His wondering face shining with mercy, he gives permission for the sad, unquiet ghost to remain on the porch. The living take their supper inside. My brother and I once camped on a blind mountain under layers of freezing nothing. The tent flap opened on dawn, shooing pink clouds high over the blue ridge. Past the rubble of rock face, we saw acres of laurel in white blossom, a deer in Japanese ink nursing her fawn. On the path to impoverishment, tenderness, in the long taking away, hearing the festival sounds through all the streets of the city. I said I'd say something further about Braces Cove, and that is this. The great Gloucester painter Fitzhenry Lane, as most of you Gloucester people know who Lane is, not everybody has seen the magnificent series on Braces Cove that Lane did toward the end of his life. He was actually dying, I think, when he did the last of these incredible, extraordinary, beautiful paintings of Braces Cove. One of them is in the Cape Ann Museum, and on the Cape Ann Museum site, there's a tremendous web collection of all five of these stunning icons. So here's speaking in Lane's voice. F.H. Lane, painter of Gloucester, Mass. Seven proud gables, my granite house kept me well. I worked high above the harbor, the ceiling striped and splashed with the ocean's reflected seasons. Call me citizen, a public man. I did banners for the parades on July 4th. An unimportant self-portrait shows me young, careless, sitting by an inlet in the sun, heedless of the tidal law, which decrees that empty must follow full. The absorbed boy artist ignores a cow with magic horns and misses another chance at myth. I have had too few grand projects the public might need. My legs crippled from childhood, my body frail. I was slow to walk and could only travel distances by sea. But a hungry mind takes note. Some of the skill in my hands came from my sailmaker father. I became known for portraits of vessels, scrupulous in every detail. They said a drawing of mine would work as a plan to build the ship. Yet any mainsail I draw is the ghost of a passing age. The five paintings of Brace's Cove came late and hard. A boy drove me out to Eastern Point on a donkey cart. Crutches were the devil on the stones. That wild rocky cove, with its sublime curve of beach, serves as my refuge. In town, locked down by winter storms, I memorized leaves and flowers, the peerless light of summer's end. I was never a man for churches. Let the cove and its great sleeping rock be my icons. In the spell of washing tides, late and early sun, the facts begin to dream, rocking to the pulse of the world. Pink and red granite, black rockweed, asters, frozen sunlight sounds an organ chord. Fragments, I was a boy playing on a beach, building small salt cathedrals. In the foreground, the dark body of a fishing boat disintegrates. I must tell you, by then I was ebbing, sick in body, in despair of the war. That's the Civil War. The future of the Republic. The dying must learn a requiem based on silences as well as notes. I may be less in the future than I am now. I swam the tides as well as my body allowed. Say that the cove was my farthest shore. I felt suspended there, transparent, glad to the brink of fear. Okay. And this is me standing with my wife at Brace's Cove. There's a custom on Brace's Cove that may have started with the retreat house, which is right there, the Jesuit retreat house. The custom is to make piles of rocks. They're sort of like cairns and piles. Religious traditions around the world, I think, do that. But anyway, lots of people who aren't religious, who just walk there, have taken it up. So especially in the summer, there are all these stone figures, some of them above the tide, some below the tide. And this this poem exploits that fact. Brace's Cove. On our early morning walk, we discover a small city left on the beach by unknown builders. Thigh-high towers of pink and gray granite, warmed by chunks of sea-smooth brick that once made houses. You ask me to wipe sunblock from your face. I do, careful with the eyes and mouth. Best of all are the standing stones, druid figures piled up from rocks and set out so the tide will wash their feet before it knocks them down. Erect amid the flowing green spartina grasses, they tilt their oval shoulders as if it were bad luck to say, so close to paradise. The title poem of the new book is Glass. And Glass is the name of a sequence of poems, of five poems. And I'm going to read a couple of them. Not the whole sequence. Glass, the five poems are basically an elegy for our son, Jody, who was born blind and with cerebral palsy, and who had, seemingly with the little he had, an extraordinary rich life. He was an amazing kid, and made friends. He was at, of course, special kinds of schools, but he made friends in places we never knew about. For all his limitations, which were immense, he seemed to have something that drew people toward him, and a kind of, he was like device that measured the mood of the room. If people were happy and joking, he was happy and joking. If people were sad, he would go that. And the sensitivity, I think, really made him kind of a favorite, even though no one ever knew actually what Jody was thinking. And he died at the age of 9, as some children that handicapped do. Anyway, so here are a few poems from Glass. The first one is Window Cleaning. Nights and years of wanting you to be like the others. Morning's colors, fetch me a dream. You're a grown-up now, a window cleaner, steady on your ladder, legs thick and strong. In short, real life, you were a brain-damaged boy in a wheelchair. Never a step once danced, or single word uttered, unbroken. Intent now on the work, you wipe the glass and survey the results. Water drips on your massive shoes. The pane of glass between you and me is charged and bright and pure, muting every sound. At last, Jody, you are like the others. And this one is called Astronomy. The child stays far. It might be the game where one hides from others. Conjure up our old house. Mix the blessings. The kitchen lights amber. A glass beehive lit from within. Call again. He may answer, though never in words. A small sound, perhaps, like an empty boat. Did he ever know his name? Faithful as bread, I read from the children's book he loved and never grasped. He knew my voice and its rhythms by heart. Little bird, where will you nest? Silence is large. It leaves room for night. He remains quiet, unseen, a star shining by daylight. All I say takes years to travel. And the last one in that sequence is Air. Air. Imagine a boy freckled and fair, blind, broken, joyful, connoisseur and emperor of farce, lover of fierce noises. He never spoke or kicked a ball or held a fork, but crooned and dined well on the scraps life served. On the last day, he clutched my hand. Wild orderlies in white wheeled the sky away. Now, when a rare ornament slips from fingers, or a glass smashes and the black wine spreads, the sound of chaos brings him back. My lolling boy, his hair copper red, laughing because he isn't dead. The Japan that we went to, my family, in 1946, was pretty devastated. In fact, every city had been leveled except two. We lived in one that was still erect, Kamakura, for the longest time. But in Yokohama, when we first were in Japan, we were right next to the Yokohama Blind School, which was, of course, the school for blind kids. Some of them blind from birth, as it says in the poem, and some from U.S. bombings. And my first experience with kids who were foreign was our neighbors, the kids at the blind school. So here's a poem about that. At the blind school, Yokohama, 1948, a stranger, some of you know a little bit of Japanese, the word gaijin is the word for foreigners. A stranger here is one who sees. The blind in school uniforms, gaijin in jeans, are playing night games, hide and seek, out where the blind know the terrain. Fireflies make lanterns in bamboo thickets. In summer's night cage, young boys are crickets, silenced, moonstruck, almost lost, some blind from birth, some from firebombings. Sato gropes with hands out, a dancing ghost. He moves close now, his fine blank face, the color of a moth's wing, his damaged eye glittering like snail shine. In cool firebursts, I feel a hand, mothy on the new bamboo with mine. And then, actually, I'm going to read the task of loving does not grow harder at all as you grow older, but the task of writing a love poem is daunting. So here's an attempt at that, that sort of names the issues. Ambition. A man of few goals, growing no younger, I wake at 5, put on sandals, a shirt and shorts, and sip coffee against the chill. It's one thing to write a love poem at 20, another at 79. Who was the professor who lectured the sophomores? He misread Eliot to say feelings must be eliminated. Boyish and tenured then, he is dead now. I think of you sleeping and see the two of us young in the house on the Wellfleet dune, the Atlantic rollers rising, trembling to crash and shake the bed. My lips taste salt. The more ocean I drink, the thirstier I am. And then let me close with just a series of new poems. My granddaughter Ruby is a freshman in Gloucester High School, and I have a poem about her when she was little, which I have her permission to use, although I don't know for how long. The contrast between the person in the poem, the young, very young person, and Ruby now, is a crack catcher in softball. She plays ice hockey, and she is actually a pretty amazing athlete, as well as probably the most avid traveler that I know. She gets the most out of any expedition anywhere. That's probably recognizable in this one. Ruby. Ruby is tender with Morgan the doll, wrapping a blanket for the split-second nap, a journey in the make-believe car, the trick of handling an imaginary wheel as she talks. Uh-oh, a turtle in the road needs help. He can't hear a thing, she explains. Similar plight and rescue of the red bear. Grief from the bad bug's bite is bottomless, then over. Rage at Ivan for grabbing her shovel is summer lightning. Here is a piece of birthday cake baked from the fine sand at Good Harbor. In green frog boots, she's busy with each of the planet's puddles, attended by Mike, the invisible friend. At last, the young mountain goat has climbed the highest bed peak. Oh, Ruby, watch out. Here comes your old enemy, sleep. And then the last two poems. I just put up late because I've been doing all this poetry stuff. I just put up the hummingbird feeder today, and immediately hummingbirds came, so it was a lucky day. This involves my soon, in a day or so, my six-year-old Lola, whose family lives in Philadelphia, but they come here a lot in the summer. And we're hanging, we're watching the hummingbird feeders. It's called In the Zone. Lola and I hang the hummingbird feeder by the window, my fingers stiff with arthritis. Two no-show dawns, then my hearing aids spark alive with bird calls. The wanderers arrive. A free fire zone unfolds like a bud or a grenade. My granddaughter's arms open wide to green wings. In the barrage of small manic thunder, I find my mother folding up stars. She blows me a kiss. Your luck holds, she says. Time has not reached the secret singing self. A bright feather lofts carelessly to dirt. And my last poem, which Dorothy was kind enough to like, it's called Softer Metal, with the quote from Nietzsche, which is kind of a overeducated thing to do. But I like the quote. The quote is, "It's a goldsmith's art, which achieves nothing if it does not achieve it lento." And of course, lento is what it is in music, they say, for doing things slowly. Nietzsche. I sell the family car and break down in scalding tears. I need to have a talk with myself, the fierce-toothed dog who panted for my death. He's asleep now, surely, in the iron kennel of the god charged with our troubles. I'm quitting the hospice. I hate dark windows. I'm walking outside where birds eat cherries, letting my soul dangle in the morning's glitter. Limbo, remember limbo? Limbo is the only happy circle in Dante's hell. True. It's where the unbaptized, babies and toddlers, ancient philosophers, get to hang out. The perfect place to practice lento, the goldsmith's patient way. At dawn, I open the door, sip strong coffee, and slowly eat a ripe peach. I may get another cat, perhaps a pair of scales to weigh what the day brings, like this first silvery mosquito. I will be the old guy who sits in the sun, aims to write one pleasing line, and bites his nails less. The hours in witness will stop their mad dance and drop hands like a circle of small children. Thanks so much. Thank you. You were the perfect audience.
I'm glad you got to eat a peach, too.
Yes.
Slowly.
Yes. Every summer. Should there be a little break, or how do we?
Like
I forget.
Do.
How do we do this? I'll do it anyway. People.
We can either.
You want to have some questions and
so
discussion
more,
now, or.
Or yeah.
Why don't we see if anyone has any questions now, so we all can hear
them. Yeah, that makes sense. Okay, I'm tired of talking at you anyway.
Thoughts
so.
Comments. I personally think it's a masterpiece. Mm.
It's beautiful. Thank you.
The new book is dedicated, I didn't say, to Lucy Brock Broido, who was a very well-known poet in not just the Boston area, but nationally, but also an amazing person to know. She ran a poetry group that ran for about 30 years every summer in Cambridge. And several different generations of poets came to it, undergraduates, poets who had published a lot, people who were just learning how to write poetry. I mean, it was all ages and all, what you might say, levels of people. And if you stuck with her and stuck with it, summer after summer, everybody in that group got better. And not only that, but everybody in the group learned how to help each other get better. And I have a group now in Cambridge called the Off Season, which was the off of Lucy's season. And it's really remarkable how the practices of helping each other help get poems better can be social and public and also learned and passed on to new groups. It's just, I mean, anyway, she was great. And there's a poem in the book about her, which I didn't read tonight, but I urge you to read it.
I have a question.
Yes.
How long have you been writing poetry, and how was it that you started?
I've almost always, at least since college, been a writer. I wanted to be a journalist, and for a long time I was an editor of the New Republic magazine as a journalist. For a very long time. And then I was more and more, I was originally hired as a literary critic, and then I was doing 60s kinds of stuff, wars over schools, segregation. And I found myself actually writing more and more about schools. So after a while, I became an expert on schools and went to teach at the Harvard School of Education. And from there, I went actually to become the principal of the Commonwealth School in Boston, and then went to run with my wife and a bunch of progressives who nobody in their right mind would give a teacher education program to, a teacher education program at Michigan State University, which is a vast teacher factory, but had a visionary dean. It was really quite a wonderful program, and we had a free hand at things. So that's a way of saying I never I never was not a writer as a grown-up. But it was only when I left the Commonwealth School that I had a year's... thank you so much. I had a year's sort of severance pay, I guess you'd say. And I heard that there were these... Some of the poets who were teaching writing at Harvard welcomed grown-ups, not just undergraduates, in their classes. And I worked with a poet named Michael Blumenthal that year, and also with a then relatively unknown poet named Seamus Heaney. Seamus actually persuaded me that I should be a poet. And however, like all poets who don't have trust funds, I needed a day job. So running the teacher ed program at Michigan State was my day job. And then every summer, I was part of the Lucy cult. People kept coming back. They would save their best, they would work really, really hard to get poems to be worked on by the group in the summertime. It was an amazing experience, really. So that's how I got to be a poet. I shifted gears and became mainly a writer of poetry in my 40s, I think. And now I'm 79, so that's a long time.
Thank you again for your writing in the New Republic back then when I was a senior in college. Ooh. I was reading.
I know that well. It had an impact on you.
It was one of the things that got me into a career in education. You wrote beautifully about the open classroom movement in England.
Yeah, the British school reforms. The Brits were doing amazing things now, which they have to some, I wouldn't say completely dismantled, but they've done, under Mrs. Thatcher, they went backwards as we started doing under Ronald Reagan. They're riddled with tests and privatization, and it sounds a lot like our troubles now with schools. I loved writing for the New Republic. I was spoiled, actually, for further journalism because the editor of the New Republic let me write on any topic I wanted to take almost... virtually, especially for magazine journalism, almost any amount of time and almost at almost any length. So those three things are actually impossible to find in most sane journalistic circles. So I was, they would be like 3- and 4-part series in the New Republic, and it was sort of the bulletin board then too for the anti-war movement, and so from the New Republic, I was on loan from the New Republic in the 1968 to write speeches for Gene McCarthy in the presidential campaign. And that was the kind of indulgence that the
Was it your idea to take the fence down around the White House?
I remember the fence well, and I remember demonstrations around it. Probably would not have been safe at that time, but it was symbolically it would have been great.
Yeah.
Yeah.
What's next? What are you writing now?
Oh, I had actually one poem that's like not very well cooked, that was called Occupy Dogtown, which is about nature stuff in Gloucester, I have just been thinking a lot more about. There are actually both these books have political poems in them, which I didn't read tonight, but I was thinking about not political, you know, not manifestos, but poems that get at some bigger issues in a small way. You know, I don't know if you've seen Erica Funkhauser's new book, of most recent book of poems, but it's just a, she gave one of the handsome blurbs on Glass, and she's a wonderful poet, but her new book ranges the way I would like to range, around a little history, a little this, a little that, family stuff mixed in. It's lovely. Well, I'm glad we settled that. Thank you. Thank you.